Coming up on Inspired, we look at faith and politics. A religion reporter is making the case in a new book that progressive faith leaders are gearing up for the election.
The Poor People's Campaign had a presidential candidates forum, and they got 9 candidates there, and there was supposed to be a 10th, but Julian Castro, like, missed his plane. They were all there because they felt that this was an influential group that could influence Democratic primary votes.
But one group that has unmistakable influence, evangelical Christians, are the target of a new communications campaign.
We hope will lead somebody to take a beat and say, you know what? That farm worker's child is just as important as my child.
And Muslims reflect on Ramadan in quarantine.
You're able to do inventory of your self-discipline, how your day went. You're able to connect in prayer sometimes in a deeper, more private, more personal way. And I think that's a really special bonus of the current situation that we're in.
That's coming up on Inspired.
So where are we sitting, Jack?
We are in Lincoln Park in Washington, D.C., in and around Capitol Hill. I feel like listeners should know, you are sitting more than 6 feet away from me.
Yes, thank you.
And like on the ground.
On the ground.
We are both speaking into microphones. It is an interview,
but it's a very
socially distanced one.
It's a socially distant, responsible interview.
I'm Amber Khan, and this is Inspired. We explore the beliefs shaping our world. This week, we start with Jack Jenkins, national religion reporter, whose new book, American Prophets, takes on one of my favorite subjects, how religious leaders are engaging in politics, advocacy, and shaping public opinion. Faith leaders exert influence on public leaders on a variety of issues, including whether houses of worship should be exempt from stay-at-home orders intended to protect public health. It's a question Jack Jenkins and his colleagues at the Religion News Service decided to investigate.
We contacted, or at least reached out to, all 50 states and many of the territories in the United States to try to figure out how governors and mayors were approaching this question of whether or not faith groups should continue to gather, at least in a large gathering. There was no consistent approach to this from governors, and it was very different. In some places, they had carve-outs just for things like funerals. Mm-hmm. In some places, you were allowed to gather in 25 or more. Some places included exemptions specifically for drive-in worship, where you could roll in with a car and still listen to the service via your AM/FM radio. And then a lot of places were very specific about saying, no, faith communities can't gather. But what was interesting and what I found is that there was even a political layer on top of that, where sometimes you would see a governor include a religious exemption that would say, you know, allow for faith communities to continue to gather. But what it meant in practice is that only 10 people at a time would be able to gather. Whereas in another state that doesn't include a religious exemption, they actually would allow for gatherings of maybe 25 or more. And so faith communities are actually able to gather in larger ways. And so it became kind of a political thing mm-hmm. for a lot of these governors to say that they were reaching out to the faith community or to say that they weren't. So at the end of the day, what we discovered is that states were kind of listening to some advocates on the ground, whether those were more conservative Christians who were clamoring to get their worship services back up and running.
To the best of your knowledge, did the White House ever offer guidance?
So it's funny you should mention that. Mike Pence did at one point finally answer a reporter's questions about this and recommended that he would not prefer that groups larger than 10 gather for faith communities. And the CDC did include some general recommendations for faith communities that included avoiding gatherings of more than 10 people. However, one, that website has changed multiple times over the course of this. I'll defer to my AP colleagues on this. Those reporters said that apparently the White House gave pressure, or there was pressure from advocates at least, that the potential guidance that the White House or the federal administration were going to put out into the public potentially could be too restrictive on faith communities. We have seen multiple instances where faith communities gathered and people got sick, and yet there does seem to be a dearth of guidance from the White House on this.
There are two things that you just mentioned that get my attention, which is the role that advocates are playing versus public health experts. What are you hearing from the faith communities across the political and ideological spectrum?
So there's kind of been two major responses to these shutdowns. And in many conservative faith communities, particularly among conservative Christians, there's actually been this push to reopen faith communities in particular, and sometimes even states in general. You have groups like the Liberty Council that have actually represented that Florida pastor who was arrested for continuing to worship despite local regulations. They're representing him in court. You actually saw the pastor who was arrested in Louisiana has retained the service of Roy Moore, the failed Alabama Senate candidate, a former judge in that state. You've seen the Liberty Council actually participate and help churches and faith communities that are suing governors over this issue. And I think, you know, you've also seen people like Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University. He actually downplayed the severity of the virus early on, and then he actually never totally closed the school. He only closed it in phases and, you know, prevented people from meeting physically in classes, but actually got a lot of flack for that, and even put out arrest warrants for reporters that were drawing attention to this. That was kind of this response among the religious right, or at least conservative Christians who often have the ear of the president. But then you have this whole other group of people who might fall under the category of the religious left or more progressive or liberal people of faith who've been preaching a very different gospel on this. In fact, the Poor People's Campaign just recently launched a campaign specifically opposing the reopening of states, saying that it would put vulnerable populations, people of color, lower income people, at risk. They're saying that this is something that they believe to be immoral and outside of the bounds of their faith to do that. And while you have heard actually one of the rallies outside of the state houses calling for the reopening of states, there was actually one of the people interviewed. They asked him whether he felt safe wearing a mask and gloves, and he said, yes, because I'm a Christian. You have heard progressive faith advocates actually argue the opposite, which is that it's because they are a Christian or a Muslim mm-hmm. or a Jew or of any number of faith communities that they feel that you should, say, release prisoners from prison who are vulnerable to catching the disease compared to other people. In fact, Union Theological Seminary in New York, a deeply liberal religious institution, actually teamed up with the ACLU to produce advertisements on that topic.
I was hungry, and you fed me. I was sick, and you healed me.
There is a real chance that the 2-year sentence will become a death sentence. I cannot sleep, I cannot breathe, and I feel like I'm going to die.
I was in prison, and you saved my life. Tell your elected leaders to save lives. Release elderly and vulnerable populations from jail and prison before it's too late.
You've seen groups like Never Again Action, a mostly Jewish group, the New York City Sanctuary Coalition, actually stage protests driving around the Immigration and Customs Enforcement offices, advocating for the release of immigrant detainees, saying that they, too, are disproportionately at risk of contracting the virus. And then you find people in California, where there was a Poor People's Campaign wing that drove around City Hall with signs in their windows advocating for those who can't afford their rent right now and pushing for some form of rent forgiveness. It's a very different message in these progressive communities than what you're hearing on the religious right.
What I'm not hearing as loudly are the church-state advocates.
Right.
When you look at that as a journalist that looks at the intersection of religion, culture, and politics, what is your takeaway? How do you make sense of that?
This is an excellent question. And I think it speaks a lot to the clout that progressive faith advocates have developed under the Trump administration. And I think that the rise of the religiously unaffiliated, or the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, has often been paired with this belief that the Democratic Party will just become increasingly secular and the progressive coalition will become increasingly godless, mm-hmm. as it were. When Trump rose to power, when he was elected, for progressives in general, he was seen as an existential threat to many of their communities and many of their values and their policy proposals. And to the religious left in particular, he was also seen as a threat to the work that they've been doing for so long. And so when you saw the resistance movement rise up against Donald Trump throughout the course of his presidency, often standing at the front of those protests were progressive faith advocates and activists.
What pulled you like a magnet to writing this book, Jack?
Well, I thought what was really interesting is that I kept reporting on these groups of people where, one, I was often, if not one of the only reporter in the room, where I would see these advocates, these activists, you know, gather in the hundreds or even the thousands, and there just not be coverage of this community as influential. And then when I dug deeper, and I would get this in little inflections in the stories I was writing at Think Progress and later at Religion News Service, that they were having influence, they were having impact. And it doesn't look like when the religious right has impact. And that's because I think the left is organized differently than the right. And I think the religious left in particular is organized differently than the religious right, because it is more a coalition of coalitions. But what that meant to me is that you really need to go in and get to know these communities to see how they have exerted influence and see who they've been able to reach and touch. So when I started launching on this journey of the book, I went back to some of the stories I had already been following in my day job and started going deeper to see, you know, who did you talk to? What rooms were you in? Where were the points of influence and what pressure points did you pinch on in the American public to help get done what you wanted? And what I found was there's a lot of people, for instance, with the Affordable Care Act, I had, you know, White House officials be like, yeah, I mean, it was Catholic nuns who helped get it done. It's weird that you don't know that. And that story happened over and over and over again, where it's this community that actually has a lot of influence. It's more ephemeral, it's more organic, and they're strategic in very specific ways for very specific causes, not as one monolithic uniform identity that always gets what it wants and pushes one party in one direction, as it were.
In a lot of the books that I've read about the religious right, yours is like the only one on my desk that documents what the other side's doing. And yours is also heavily tilted towards Judeo-Christian.
Right.
You've got a deep dive into what I would call the primary power brokers, mm-hmm. In that progressive left movement. How do you approach writing the book about a side that no one thinks is a side?
I think it is one of those things where there have been any number of reporters who have covered it in their day job, and there have been a couple of books that have, you know, glanced at this, but often they're either written by advocates, you know, telling their own stories, or they're written by people who are faith leaders who are reflecting on this in a theological way from their specific faith tradition.
Yeah, like Jim Wallis or even
yes.
Jonathan Wilson Hargrove. When you sat down to write this book, did you feel like you were breaking some new ground here?
Yeah, I mean, like, there are stories in the book that I know are new, that are technically scoops. And I do kind of feel like it's one of those things where I want to acknowledge that it's not an easy thing to cover, the religious left. There's so many things going on. And as you noted, I wasn't trying to give a collective census of what the religious left is and who all is within it. I was trying to point to the places of the highest levels of influence. And so, as you note, it's actually an inherently interfaith movement. While the religious left used to be pretty uniformly Christian back in like the early 20th century, now it has to be interfaith because that's the glue that holds it together. But, you know, some of the biggest points of influence have been like Catholic leaders, for instance, or the Black Protestant leaders. Those have been the places where they've been able to actualize power in the last 15 years. And what's interesting is that no one has really done a work in a broad sense outside of a sociological context or, like you said, a theological context to kind of tell these stories as they happened, you know, to kind of say, let's give a contemporary history. And that was the goal of my book, was to look at the past 5 to 15 years of the religious left's history and say, how has this group actually been deeply influential? But looking at these groups that are helping get laws passed and are helping change the outcome of elections, but in ways that just look different than the religious right. And again, I just don't think there were that many people looking at that topic to begin with.
Do you think that more reporters outside the religion beat paying attention to William Barber, paying attention
right.
to these movements, is that in itself a sea change? Do you think that this is a sign of an awakening, especially as we go into another election cycle?
Yeah, and I think there's a few different factors informing that. So, for instance, you know, one of my chapters, I talk about Standing Rock and Mauna Kea and indigenous activists out in Hawaii. And I knew before I did that I couldn't just call up those activists. I had to go out there and earn trust. And that's how you often are able to report on activists, is they trust you as a reporter. It doesn't mean you write what they want you to write, but it does mean that they trust that you're going to tell it accurately and at least take what they're saying seriously. That trip out to Hawaii left me horrifically sunburned, but it did earn me some of the pieces that I was able to tell. And since advocacy and activism has been such an important part of the resistance movement to Trump over the last 3 years, I think a lot of journalists have been like, hey, you know, like, we have to take these activists seriously. Because if you're trying to cover progressivism in the United States, that's been the main vehicle of public discourse over the last 3 years, is these demonstrations, these protests, these activists.
We have the most unusual set of circumstances. I mean, I'm sitting here interviewing you in a park because of a pandemic, 6 feet apart, right? When you take a step back and you look at what's going on in the faith community and the stakes that many of these groups have laid on this election and what this holds, how do you see those faith groups and the groups that you covered in the book preparing for 2020 turnout?
This is a good question because it gets at what I think is the key to why these groups have started cropping up again, right? So like last summer, the Poor People's Campaign had a presidential candidates forum, and they got 9 candidates there, and there was supposed to be a 10th, but Julian Castro like missed his plane. And so they all showed up. You had Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. They were all there speaking to this group of activists and advocates because they felt that this was an influential group that could influence Democratic primary votes. It's notable that a few days later or a couple weeks later, when Netroots Nation happened, they had their own presidential candidates forum, and only 4 candidates showed up, as it were, and they weren't necessarily the front runners. And that's an established liberal, progressive convening. And so for them to kind of trail behind the Poor People's Campaign says a lot about the clout that this group has started to accrue, even among the Democratic establishment. Fast forward to 2020, I don't think it's coincidental that when the Biden campaign became one of the first campaigns to hire a faith outreach director in South Carolina, that by December of last year, they had the endorsement of 100 faith leaders just in that state, and that Joe Biden also cleaned up in that state among African-American Protestants. When I was reporting in February on the campaign in the Democratic primary, I walked into a Joe Biden office, and there on the wall was a sign that said, "Preacher's Heart, Joe Biden." And the faith outreach element permeated every piece of his campaign because he knew that African-American Protestants and the faith that they exude is very important in a rhetorical sense and also in a turnout sense. So when you're looking ahead to 2020, some of the more classic groups, right? So African-American Protestants have often organized mobilizing forces, you know, souls to the polls, as it were, when people were bused from church to polling locations. Or you see these faith groups who are now in states like Missouri invoking their faith to say that they should be able to vote from home because the state isn't sure whether they would grant an exception to allow you to absentee vote just because you fear contracting the coronavirus. But faith is a thing that you can get an exception for. So now groups of rabbis and pastors are now launching this campaign to get vote by mail in their state. Because,
oh, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. Because they see it to be very important. And it's actually spreading to other states now because they're not the only state that's in that situation. I think what's interesting about this pandemic context is that so many advocates, religious and otherwise, are still trying to figure out what voter mobilization looks like. You know, how do you get people to a ballot box safely when people are concerned of contracting an illness that could kill them? Or, contrary to that, how do you get a state legislator or, you know, a governor to allow for vote by mail in a state that allows everyone to stay home? How do you knock on those doors without having to knock on those doors? You know, and so I think that's the big question moving forward, is these progressive faith communities continue to advocate for disenfranchised communities, those who are often left out or forgotten as far as they're concerned. But how they're going to do that, I think, is something they're still figuring out. I think there's so many more stories to tell. And so I'll definitely continue to have my day job where I cover these movements because I think that they are important, not because I'm advocating for them, but because if you want to understand American politics, you have to understand these groups as far as I'm concerned. Hopefully they'll let me write a volume 2, which I will say this. If Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, is elected president come November, I do think the religious left will look different. And it is going to be an interesting question as to whether it resembles how it looked underneath the Obama administration, or if this newfound clout and power that they've accrued over the past 3 years shows up in the Biden administration.
For a listener who is not really that into religion and politics, what's your elevator pitch for why I should read this book, Jack Jenkins?
I think you can understand the modern Democratic Party or the modern progressive coalition without understanding the religious left. They're not going away. And so if you're curious to see what will the future of our republic look like, it's going to help to know the names of these people or at least understand the groups that are giving rise to the kinds of rhetoric we're hearing presidential candidates issue. And if you don't take that seriously, I think you're missing what's really happening in the American experiment.
That was Jack Jenkins, National Religion Reporter for the Religion News Service and author of American Prophets, The Religious Roots of Progressive Politics and the Ongoing Fight for the Soul of the Country. Before we head into the break, we are going to play an excerpt from a highlight reel produced by the Poor People's Campaign. It begins with the campaign co-leader, Reverend Liz Theo Harris, introducing some of the people who make up the movement Jenkins described.
I want to tell you about some of the leaders who are building the Poor People's Campaign. Callie Greer from Selma, Alabama, who had to bury her daughter, Venus, because she didn't have health care.
I'm here today to share my daughter's Venus's story. Venus discovered a small lump in her breast and she wasn't insured. Venus had to be approved for every prescription and every piece of medical equipment that she needed. I'm standing here today in solidarity with the Poor People's Campaign because no one should have to bury their child in America because they don't have health care insurance.
I'm 46 years old. I've lived in poverty here in West Virginia every day of my life. And I'm working. I am working poor with a bachelor's degree. I'm doing the best I can with what I have.
I'm a second generation fast food worker and I've experienced the cycle of poverty firsthand. Growing up, I watched my mother endure long hours of backbreaking labor, doing everything she could to feed me and my sisters. My employer barely pays me enough to pay rent and utilities, let alone with the medical expenses with my mother.
I worked 41 years in the coal mines. I have black lung, and it's just unfathomable what these poor coal miners have to go through in order to get what they have worked for and deserve.
Coming up, we take a closer look at a campaign seeking to engage conservative and evangelical faith leaders in the South and Southeast to see immigrants as all of us. Stay with us. I hope you're enjoying this week's show. I wanted to take a short break to tell you a few things about Inspired that you may not know. Our show was founded by a nun named Maureen Fiedler, who in the days after 9/11 saw a need for a national broadcast that would explore the rich diversity of beliefs among Americans. Since then, our commitment to creating and producing compelling radio has never wavered, nor has our commitment to making it available to everyone for free. No paywalls ever. But it's not free to produce this show, and we don't receive any funds from National Public Radio or the local stations that carry us. So I need to ask you for your support. If you enjoy Inspired, if you value it and count on it, please consider donating today. You can do that on our website at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. And thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.